Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to witness some scenes from the next attraction to play this theater. This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset. We urgently recommend that if you are such a person or the parent of a young or impressionable child now in attendance, that you and the child leave the auditorium for the next 90 seconds.
Good evening, you sick motherfuckers. Welcome to another episode of the Video Nasty Project, the show that brings you all the horror movies that the moral, uptight guardians of the UK wanted to keep out of your hands, you sick little monkeys. Tonight, it's Hammer time.
I told you, homeboy, you can't touch this.
No, I mean the other Hammer. I mean we're cracking open the toolbox for the Toolbox Murders. Why don't you check out the trailer and we'll be back in a second.
This man is about to commit the most atrocious crimes in American history. Linda Githens, age 22. Valerie Hoffman, age 24. Marianne Stevens, age 21. These women have one thing in common. They are all victims of the Toolbox Murders.
What the hell are you doing?
Toolbox Murders. On July 23rd, 1977, a hooded killer terrorized a small suburb of Los Angeles, California. His identity was unknown, but he committed a series of crimes so fiendish that it shocked the entire country. He struck with no warning. He preyed on innocent young women. In his hands, simple tools became the instruments of death. Screaming, but for the one still alive, the worst was yet to come. The Toolbox Murders, a true story. When you stop screaming, you'll start talking about it.
And welcome back. We just got done seeing the Toolbox Murders and not the Driller Killer. That's an entirely different Toolbox Murder. This movie essentially does what it says on the tin. You've got Cameron Mitchell. He owns an apartment building. There are a couple of men in there, but it's mostly women. And they're all of various stripes. You've got your lush older lady. She likes the sauce. You've got the one lady who's dancing in front of her bay windows in her underwear. So you have all these crazy sinners running around in the apartment house. Mm-hmm. And then Cameron Mitchell, he comes in and murders the fuck out of them with tools from his toolbox. Hence the Toolbox Murders. And that's the movie essentially in a nutshell. So the movie opens under the credits. You see somebody driving. You don't actually see who it is. It's all from their point of view. And they're driving through downtown LA in the middle of the night. And I love that scene because the lighting is so cool with, like, the neon lighting and stuff.
The thing that I found a little bit disjointed about it is that this sequence also includes flashbacks. But the editing isn't done it well enough to me. I mean, knowing that you're supposed to see a flashback, you see it. But if you watch it and you're not knowing that a flashback is supposed to happen, you miss that it was a flashback. Because the trigger for the main flashback is as he drives past an auto dealership.
Yeah, an old AMC dealership.
Yeah, and as he and you get an establishing shot of the dealership, and then him driving again, and then it's back to the shot of the dealership, but now there's a car accident. And the first time I saw it, I was like, did he just come up on a car accident? Oh, no, actually, this is the car accident in which his daughter died.
And it's a little weird because we never actually see car impacting with telephone pole. We only see the aftermath. And, like, there's this one shot where they open the door and she flops out and her arm just floomp out of the onto the street. And it's really weird. And you're like, there's no context to what's going on.
You don't know who she is. And what the connection is. It's
now, this all pays out later at the very end of the movie. You get the information that, oh, that's, it was his daughter. Oh, it now fits into the giant piece of the puzzle.
I think it would have been stronger if there had been a connection to the women he killed and his daughter being dead. Maybe if one or more of them had been in a car and cut her off, or she knew these people and she was on a down spiral, maybe doing drugs, you know, because porn stars use a lot of drugs, and maybe she was doing some freebase and then crashed or some shit like that.
Or if you were able to reinforce the stronger parallel between Kathy, the dead daughter, and Pamela and her kidnapping, you know, that they had the same vices, that they had the same habits, and they wore the same sort of clothes. If not necessarily they were the same person, enough that Cameron Mitchell's trigger makes sense.
Yeah, and I think he mentioned that the two looked similar to each other, which is, and I've seen this in other movies, including one more recent one where a bad guy kidnapped a woman because she looked like his daughter or somebody he was related to.
The movie is a Frankenstein of three other movies. You have the first 30 minutes where it's this incredibly intense and violent movie.
Yes.
And then you get the second half of the movie, the next 30 minutes or so, where it's this police procedural coupled with, how did you put it and when we were watching it, the Hardy Boys mystery.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It definitely does that.
Yeah.
And then the third half of the movie is a weird character study.
My take on it was that this movie, it basically started off as one thing, and they probably had the intention of making it holistically the same throughout, but it didn't end up that way. Maybe partway through the shoot, the director had an idea and went, aha! And the script kind of just evolved into something that wasn't as schlocky as it started out, but then by doing that, you've kind of undercut the schlock if that was what you were aiming for to begin with. And it can't decide what it wants to be. It's kind of schizophrenic in a way.
The opening of the movie is what worked the best for me. Mm. And I loved, like, the attention to, like, detail.
Yeah.
The scene where you had the older lady, the older Lush, and Cameron Mitchell attacks her with the power drill.
Mm-hmm.
And gets her arm on the first attack. And then she runs into the bathroom and slams the door. And you see him lunging at the camera lens. And there's this little chunk of meat on the blade as it's still spinning. I thought that was just kind of, I don't know, that bit made me happy.
Okay, it made you happy. The thing that that annoys me is that scene concludes with him putting the ski mask on, which goes, oh, she knew her killer. Because, of course, oh, you're here to, because the scene opens with, oh, you're here finally to fix it, but he doesn't say anything. It's like, when you know your killer and you're pleading with them, you usually do something like utter their name.
And there was no connection between the, I know who you are, why are you coming at me with a drill?
I think the whole segment with him putting on the ski mask could have been dropped and just presented that he had it on the whole time.
Or edit it so that it's the very first thing.
Yeah.
So the first 30 minutes of the movie are really strong. You get a really intense, lots of murders. It's very sleazy. The soundtrack was kind of interesting. It's all this diegetic sound. So it's all people listening to radios and stuff as they're doing their daily business in their apartments. So it's this weird disjointed from the soundtrack.
And it has some really great music in it. I mean, it has the type of music that was typical back in those days. A lot of piano-based with some orchestration behind it, maybe a little synth of a sort to add tension.
Like they had that, the porn star diddling herself in the bathtub has this weird, almost kind of country western folk music going on, and I love the hell out of that.
The point of where the source of the music is punctuated specifically with, there's a point where the album, it's one of those record players where the last track is completed, and it automatically, the arm lifts, goes back to the beginning and sets itself down again. And that's where the R killer walks up and interrupts that song by boop. And then he leaves the apartment for his next victim and new music.
The porn queen, she's featured on the cover of the box. And she's the one kind of clutching her breasts and no, don't kill me, don't kill me. She gets the most extended, protracted death of the bunch.
Mm. And unlike a lot of victims he's come up against, this one's actually about the same size. She's toe-to-toe. She's looking him in the face. They're about the same height, although she's built a lot thinner. He's this bulky guy. But, you know, generally a lot of these psycho killers like to get smaller victims so they can dominate them. He's not doing it with this woman. You know, so clearly they have detente, you know, going at them. He doesn't have the height advantage. She doesn't have the weight advantage. But it makes for an interesting power dynamic in this scene.
He manages to injure her. He hits her with one nail from the nail gun. And then the slow, protracted, I'm just going to put this up against your head. Punk.
The effects done were
well.
Good.
It's done well. But it was just, and so my initial, you know, the third death, this being the fourth. So I'm back up and like, okay, I see where this is going. We're going to, you know. Then it jumps to the police showing up because the couple finds Debbie and her roommate and blah, blah, blah.
And that's where the wheels fall off the wagon.
And I'm like, this was the point where for me, whereas I quite literally got about another 5-10 minutes and went, fast forward, fast forward, fast forward. More of the same, fast forward, fast forward, fast forward. More of the same, fast forward, more of the same. Rewind all the way back to where I started my fast forwarding bit and went, I've got to see what the hell, what, you know, that I can't just fast forward my way through this film. I've got to, you know, plot exposition, blah, 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 play and wait.
It is a very, very flabby second act. It could have been tightened up and reemphasized so much better.
And about the only real issue I had with this film was the handling of a couple of things. Firstly, the character of Joey, who is the brother of the kidnapped victim, Lori,
mm-hmm.
who's the centerpiece of this thing. He comes off as kind of the really nice, scrubbed Luke Skywalker before he, you know, meets up with Obi-Wan kid, who wants to, you know, find out what the hell's happened to his sister, but it doesn't feel like he has the emotional intensity and the what the fuck, what the fuck, what the fuck that he needs.
He doesn't sell the problem. He doesn't sell the issue. He doesn't feel like a brother that's freaking out that his sister's been kidnapped.
Yeah, he doesn't cry. He doesn't do any of the stuff that, you know, when he and his mother, where their mother are talking, it's more like he's got things to do. Hey, Mom, I'm going to borrow the car for a few minutes. I'll be right back. And he doesn't even talk to her about anything that's going on with his sister. He just grabs a car and then he goes and does a little detective work or something.
You know who does sell that second half? Wesley Uhr, mm-hmm. the kid from Land of the Lost, of Marshall, Will, and Holly, of the group.
Yeah,
he sells the fuck out of the middle.
Yeah, he is all stares and stuff, and they basically kind of give him away, I think, in a manner of speaking, because it's all in the eyes. He does a lot of really good stares and looks, and when people leave the room, his expression alters slightly. If you don't pick it up, it's because it's put all in here. It's not in here.
Well, that's one of the reasons why when Joey's death arrives, I was expecting it. I wasn't surprised by it. It's like you telegraphed it. Kent is a killer, but he's not the killer.
I really liked that scene. In that, you want to talk intensity. That scene where he sets his friend on fire. So he douses him with gasoline, and he's got this book of matches, and he's flicking the matches and throwing them at him, trying to set him on fire. And Joey is running around the table in the garage going, no, don't set, don't do this. And he's just this, it's so, oh my God.
It's not over the top in terms of, like, overacting. It feels over the top in terms of the intensity is amped up to 11 as opposed to 10. Because you know Joey's going to get set on fire. He's not going to escape this one. As there's not going to be a last-minute save. This is a pair of boys, you know, doing each other in. This is the kind of stuff you expect adults to do to each other or an adult to do to teenagers, like in slasher films. When you have two kids going at it, it feels more, you know, I want to say really uncomfortable because, you know, kids will be kids, but this is taking, you know, sort of the natural tendency for kids to play with matches, and then, phew, I was like, fuck, how does the Kent kind of come back from this?
If he wanted to get away from his teen beat, tiger beat, squeaky clean image that he had been fostering early on, this was certainly going to be the move to do it.
Very much so. I mean, it's totally a cast against type. You wouldn't imagine seeing him in a role like that after seeing a TV series like Land of the Lost, where he demonstrated really good acting chops. So, is he wasted in this film? No. I'm just disappointed that the beginning of the film disconnects for the second act, and then when the third act comes in to play, I can't get into it.
The other bit of acting that I really, really enjoyed out of the movie was Cameron Mitchell and Pamela Ferdin.
Yeah.
Those two have great chemistry together. So the beginning of the third act has Pamela tied up in Cameron Mitchell's daughter's old bedroom. And she's surrounded by, like, frilly dolls and, like, plushy toys and stuff like that. And she's wearing, I'm presuming, one of her old clothes. So it's kind of little kitty. And Cameron Mitchell comes in and tries to seduce her with, like, a lollipop and is talking crazy talk to her. And she tries to manipulate and play the situation to her advantage. And the chemistry between the two is really fucking strong.
Yeah, Cameron Mitchell, I mean, all he has to do is walk into a room and you just get it right away. It's just like he commands the entire place and you just wind him up and let him go. And, I mean, the man will deliver, boom. I mean, he's old school actor, trained the old fashioned way, he gets it right, you know. And, I mean, this lumbering man with this intensity, I mean, he's no stoop either. You can't fool this guy, you know. He knows his own mind. He's not going to be tricked by, you know, some adolescent kid trying to make him think something he's not going to think. And when he and when Vance and Kent go at it, when they were having their encounter in the kitchen, I was just thinking, oh my God, this huge guy is just going to pound this little kid into paste. Because that's what it felt like, because he wanted to just, like, strangle him. And then out comes this knife. And I want to say this gives me one of the best creepy images. So Vance has this doll, and it's one of these baby dolls that's in a white dress. And Kent has this knife, and Vance grabs it, and his hand is all bloody and stuff, and the doll's dress gets covered in gore. Then Kent stabs him, and then he's done. Then Kent goes and washes the dress off, but he can't get all the red out. It's just like he needs Visine to get all this shit out. And so he goes back into the bedroom, and he undoes, you know, Pamela's bonds and stuff, and he has this doll with this slight pink tinge to it. I'm thinking, oh, God, this is sick. This is so fucking nasty. It's great.
And then the very, very end of the movie. So Wesley comes in and basically rapes her, which fortunately we don't see. But it's very strongly implied that that's where this scene is going to go. And Pamela, she reaches over and grabs a pair of scissors off of the nightstand. Cut to my favorite shot of the entire movie of Pamela, she's walking along through this parking lot, and it's like sunrise, and you've got the golden hour light just starting to come up behind her, and it just freeze frames, and then you get the text that this is a real story, which is bullshit, but you know, whatever. And just that scene is gorgeous.
I mean, this movie is full of some goodness, but and it also has some, you know, parts that aren't so good, I mean, here and there, but yeah, for the most part, it's really good. Now, the one thing that that I do remember when we were talking about before is how Kent is covering up some of the murders. He's not covering up. Okay, so the murders happen in this apartment, and his job is to go in and refurbish, take out the carpet, paint over the blood and stuff, and he doesn't have the reaction of somebody who's an innocent or doesn't see a lot of blood. He's just kind of like, eh, okay, fine.
That's the first tell of the movie that Kent isn't necessarily on the up and up, because you've got... So what he does is, you know, Cameron Mitchell says, hey, you know, go clean up the apartments and I'll give you $50. And he goes to Joey and says, hey, man, you know, I'll split the money with you. Come help me clean up. And they get into the house where, you know, there's blood on the walls and blood on the floor and bloody pretty much everywhere from the murders. And he's all like, I'm cool with this. And he's looking at the wall and it's like, no, I'm fine with that. And Joey finds a vibrator under the bed and throws it at him and is like, ooh, disgusting, and throws it down.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tell where, yeah, something's not right with him.
Yeah, because the big thing about Vance is he doesn't like promiscuous women. He doesn't like promiscuity. He's a Bible thumper. And he's clearly passed on this mentality to his nephew.
Mm-hmm.
Kent gets this dildo and like, ah, no, that's been with like the vag and maybe dirty pillows and maybe up the bum. And so he kind of drops it. And one other thing that's interesting, when he's shown just being around and doing nothing in particular, he's wearing all black and stuff like that, or mostly black. When he's doing the painting, he's wearing this light colored shirt, which has paint all over it. And I'm thinking, well, how the hell do you paint walls, motherfucker? Because he's, you know, plastered. And I'm thinking, is that a directorial thing, or is that, you know, some mistake they made? But it makes it look like whenever he's his most pristine is when he's not around doing these tasks, and that he's kind of in the fullness of his character, and dark is definitely his motif. That's his métier. And he looks kind of, he acts a little meeker and weaker when he's doing the painting thing. When the cop comes in, this detective who's been doing the background checks and checking out Joey and takes him to the interrogation room early on and treats Joey like they always treat any boy or man in a movie where there's a murder. The detective always goes for the family or the best friend, the convenient, you know, basically victim, as it were, because you want somebody to pin this shit on and then, or get him to sing or whatnot. And this guy is no different from those.
So you got anything else left you got to say?
Not really. This is one of those films, if you're looking at a category of films like from a decade or from a movie maker and you're a completist, okay, yes, please watch the film. If you're not like that, you can actually skip this one.
If you're going to watch the movie, watch the first half hour, enjoy the visceralness, and then just turn it off.
But then if you do that, you're going to miss Cameron Mitchell's scene chewing bit.
Yeah.
So I would say, with respect to Cameron Mitchell, at least watch those creepy ass bits.
So was the Toolbox Murders nasty?
Oh yeah. Incest, seduction of a youth by a middle-aged man, or more than middle-aged. Yeah. That's pretty nasty.
Blood splatter everywhere.
I mean, just rampant misogyny from one end to the other.
From a strictly technical standpoint, if you're looking at just violence and gore, you'll get more blood in a Ric Flair match where he blades himself.
Woo!
When you get into the themes of the movie, into the constant rampant misogyny, when you get to the fact that Cameron Mitchell is tying up and kidnapping and seducing a underage teenager, that shit gets put on the nasty list in my book.
Yeah, especially when he has this charms pop. He's got one of those two-tone charms pops. And he's just licking it and licking it kind of seductively. I mean, the Chester meter is way the fuck up here. I mean, is this guy, will he or won't he?
My suspicion is that when the DPP took a look at this movie and put it on the list, they didn't get past the first 30 minutes. They just went a couple of kills into it and said, on the list, fuck it. No. This is no good.
They said naked, dead woman chased around. I mean, lots of full frontal. I mean, it's like full frontal, like holding on the shot. It's not just cut away. I mean, there's crotch floss to spare.
the other poison pill in the chalice, I'm going to bet, was the Driller Killer. They saw the cover for the Driller Killer. They said, this is obviously nasty, and threw that on the list. And then they got to the Toolbox Murders and then instantly assumed it's probably going to be more of the same, put it on the list.
And ironically, there's no real sexualized violence, even though some of the kills are aimed at members of the sex working community.
All right. On the nasty list, nasty, nasty, nasty. It's nasty, which is a shocking result when this far deep into the end of the list.
Well, it goes to show just how inconsistent, and provides the evidence that a number of the films that were on the prosecuted list were there simply because of an arbitrary, it looks bad, let's prosecute it.
Ian, did you like the Toolbox Murders?
I wanted to, but no.
I think you and me are in the same boat with this movie.
And largely my problem with the film is the fact that the script had a number of really good ideas, and they just didn't go from the page to the camera properly.
Generally speaking, I think the movie is strong except for the script. And really, the script only falls down in the middle act. It starts really strong, falls apart in the middle act, has a not too bad ending.
Yeah.
So I think it's a technically well-done movie in all respects other than that.
I liked it enough that if I wasn't doing something like, say, a year from now and I had it in my queue, maybe I'd watch it again.
All right, so you liked it, didn't like it. I'm kind of indifferent, leaning on the borderline between yay and nay. So, all right. That sounds like an episode then, doesn't it?
Right.
Thank you for sticking around for the 20 or so minutes that it took us to dissect the Toolbox Murders. Be sure to check back in next week for... Oh, right. Next week. Next week we have an actual legitimate surprise for you guys. It's going to be really kind of cool. We're taking a look at Unhinged, and, well, I don't want to give it away. So, check back in. In the meantime, why don't you drop me an email? TheVideoNastyProject@gmail.com, and we'll catch you then. Until then, stay evil!
You liar, you dirty, filthy fornicator! Sinner!